You're listening to Human Rights 2020's podcast with the Human Rights Consortium Scotland. This podcast is all about how we protect human rights in Scotland, and we are delighted today to have Naomi McAuliffe from Amnesty International in Scotland. Naomi, do you want to tell us a bit about yourself?
Yes, thanks very much, Vary. I'm Naomi, head of Amnesty's Scotland office. I've worked for Amnesty for coming up for 15 years now, both in Edinburgh and in our London office as well. Obviously, I kind of ran back to Scotland as soon as I could to take up this role. And it's a fascinating time to be involved in human rights in Scotland. And I think we're going to be covering a lot of that today.
Indeed, we are going to talk obviously about human rights in the midst of COVID-19 and all the impacts of that, whether it's the COVID itself or some of the responses to it. There's so much to cover, but we're going to talk specifically about Amnesty International and what you've been doing kind of in response to COVID-19. So can you tell us a bit about what you think are some of the main impacts of COVID-19 on human rights of people living in Scotland?
Yeah, definitely. And as you say, there's the impacts of the disease itself on people's lives and ability to go out, but also on the impacts of the laws and the regulations on all of us. I mean, this is completely unprecedented that we have had our freedom of movement interfered with to such a huge degree. There's really nothing comparable. Even during wartime, there often isn't the amount of lockdowns that we have experienced. So that in itself raises a lot of concerns. I think everyone completely understands the legitimacy of the lockdown and not being able to leave your house or only to do it once a day. But how that is then overseen by the authorities, how it's enforced by the police and by others, that's where human rights kicks in, as we've got to make sure that there's not a disproportionate response by the state to people's human rights. So some of the kind of key things that we were focusing on, particularly at the start of the pandemic, was things such as making sure that those who were on the front line, so healthcare workers and other essential workers, had proper PPE. So they had proper protection in the work that they did. And if we remember back to that time, it seems a very long time ago now, but only 5 months ago, there was a huge shortage. And that was interfering with the rights of workers themselves, that they were being put in the front line and at risk of contracting a potentially fatal disease without being properly protected by the state. And as time has gone on and we've having the easing of lockdown restrictions, more and more people are being put in that situation. So those who are shop workers, working on transport, are far more at risk, have an elevated risk to contracting the disease. Both the state and private companies need to make sure that they understand their obligations to keep their staff safe. So that was a really key area. Obviously, during a pandemic, a huge issue is access to healthcare, and we're very fortunate to have the NHS in this country, but there are people within the UK who are under different forms of immigration control, which means that there are some barriers to accessing healthcare, and people with certain types of visas have to pay for their healthcare in the UK. And again, that is a decision that's made by the state. In a time of pandemic, that could mean that there are people who might be showing symptoms, who are concerned that accessing healthcare might alert the authorities to their immigration status, or they might be charged and they're worried that they don't have enough money to pay for it. All of these things might make people reluctant to seek the healthcare that they need and that all of us need to get as well. So one of the things that we were asking the UK government, because obviously it's a reserved issue, was to ensure that there would be no fees for any person within the UK, depending on their immigration status. Similarly connected to that, there's also an ongoing issue around women who are under immigration control not being able to access women's refuges if they're fleeing domestic abuse. And again, we were asking for suspending the no recourse to public funds rule to ensure that in this particular time, it's an ongoing issue, obviously, but in this particular time that women had access to refuges. And then we had issue coming up again, we work quite a lot on policing. And as I said, the police were involved in, for the first time, public health and enforcing public health regulations. And this is very new and unusual. And we've seen huge variations across the UK in how the police have responded to that. One of the things that's very different about Scotland is that Police Scotland set up an independent advisory group with the explicit remit of looking at the human rights and equalities impacts of these new laws and regulations around coronavirus. And that was hugely positive. As I say, Amnesty are on that group in Scotland. Those groups didn't exist anywhere else in the UK at the start of the pandemic. And it's been, I think, really beneficial for the police to be hearing from both human rights and equalities experts across the different equality strands about the disproportionate impact of the laws and regulations on different groups, and have been able to then respond in real time to the policing of the pandemic.
You raise a really good point there about, in many ways, COVID-19 has actually restricted the human rights of all of us, but it has had a particularly disproportionate impact on particular groups. Can you talk about what are some of the groups or some of the issues around the policing in the midst of COVID?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, one of the things that has been great on the independent advisory group has been the organisations involved. So we've particularly heard from disabled people's organisations or campaign groups representing people with autism, and also children and young people. We've been hearing a lot about those impacts too. So, for example, if you're in lockdown, having your movement restricted and you live in a big, massive house, then that's very different from someone who is living in very small accommodation, who don't have access to a green space on their doorstep, who might be in cramped conditions. And then when they are or have been at the beginning of lockdown, allowed out for once a day for exercise only. A lot of people, particularly with hidden disabilities, were reporting that they were being questioned about some of their behaviours. So, for example, people who needed to take a rest when they were out for a walk on a park bench, then being approached by the police to question why they were sitting down was often very intimidating for people, but also could lead to a kind of escalation of the situation too. So it was very important that the police were sensitised to the different issues and context that people are coming to. They could be more sensitive and more sensible about enforcing the regulations. And I think that, again, there have been lots of individual instances which the police action has been questioned. But in general, across Scotland, there has been a huge amount of adherence by everyone in Scotland to the regulations, and also quite a positive response to the way that the police have handled it too. And I think a lot of that has come from advocacy groups explaining to the police the very particular situations that a lot of people are finding themselves in, and how they're very different and differential for those groups. We've also commented before as Amnesty UK-wide as to the disproportionate impact of the disease itself on Black and minority ethnic groups as well. And, you know, certainly those who were frontline workers, but also the statistics were showing, particularly in England, that BAME people were more likely to contract COVID-19 and to die from it. So we've called for a public inquiry into that fact. It has been looked into in Scotland as well, and an expert group has been set up to look at this particular issue.
I know from our consortium members have expressed quite a lot of frustration that the data is just not there to know the impact on different groups sometimes. So they know from their experience on the ground, from speaking to people about their kind of own experiences, but that overarching national or even local authority data is often just not there, is missing. And if we don't count it, what does that mean? It's not important. I don't know if you've come across that issue, particularly around policing, but maybe around that, those impacts on Black and ethnic minority communities.
Definitely. It's a perennial moan from a lot of different civil society organisations, and it is often not a very sexy topic, but it's so vitally important, because if we don't have the data, if we can't scrutinise it properly, then we can't pick up on the trends, and we can't pick up on where people are falling through the net and where, you know, there is a problem until it becomes such a big problem that it becomes noticeable. But you can trace these back if you have the data for it. So one of the outcomes from all of this that I really hope is going to happen is that all of our data collection, not just from the police, but local authorities and everywhere else, gets a lot better, because now we realise really the kind of impact of not having this data means it's really hard to make proper decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. So now we're lockdown is a little bit eased, what are Amnesty International's three big calls now in terms of the impacts of COVID, and recognising that obviously there's always a risk of a second wave, so we want to learn some things from this as well, but what do you want to see happen now?
I think the three big things I think that we could group them in is, firstly, that we need to have a public inquiry into the decisions that were made around COVID. And this is something that the First Minister has already agreed to, so we know that it's going to happen, but we need to make sure that that public inquiry covers everything that it needs to cover. And this isn't just about finding out who made the wrong decisions, or, you know, who's to blame for if we went into lockdown too late, or if we went into it in the wrong kind of way. It's not just a blame game, although there needs to be proper accountability. It's also so that we can learn the lessons. As you say, we've already had local lockdowns in Scotland. I presume that's still likely to happen. And COVID seems to be something that is going to be part of our life for quite a long time. It's not over yet, and I don't think it's going to be over for a long time. So we really do need to learn from our mistakes and also learn from the things that went well, because we're likely to have to make those same kind of decisions again. And something that, again, I think a lot of organisations have highlighted is the need to do human rights and equality impact assessments on these decisions that are being made. Because, again, it's If you don't put in the proper thought into these decisions, then you will have this differential impact on different people. And already, you know, certainly the women's sector in Scotland has brought up how the differential impacts that a lot of different decisions were or potentially could have had on women. So a decision about when or how children go back to school is not just about children's access to education, it's also about childcare and who's going to be doing that childcare and what kind of impact it's going to have on the groups who are most likely to provide childcare. So all of these things have to be thought through, and a proper and comprehensive and independent public inquiry will hopefully give us a lot of really substantial information so that we can, going forward, make our decisions even better and more human rights-based. Kind of connected to that, I would say the other big call is around access to justice and to remedy. So this is making sure that those people who have been adversely impacted by COVID, so not only the families of bereaved people, but also those who have been left with morbidity. We're finding out a lot more about people who are being left with chronic lung problems after having had COVID. And if those people contracted it while at work, while they were in a care home in which patients were being discharged to, we need to be able to ensure that those people are able to take either the state or local authorities or health boards or whoever is the duty bearer, take them to court in order to access justice and remedy for that, and that there aren't barriers put in their way. There's already been a lot of work around incorporating economic, social and cultural rights, as well as other treaties that the UK has signed up to, into Scots law. And although that seems all very abstract, actually COVID provides a very good example of why that's so necessary. So this includes things such as the right to education, the right to housing, the right to healthcare. And if these are protected in law, it means that when there are these circumstances where people are could potentially slip through the net, that we already have a protection in law to make sure that they don't hit rock bottom. I would say that the third most important thing is that recovering from COVID means looking at our human rights laws and the human rights framework that we have in Scotland and ensuring that we have got the strongest framework that we could have. COVID has really shown us how necessary and how vital the rights to housing, to healthcare, to education are to us. And making sure that that is protected in law so that no one can fall beneath the safety net when it comes to access to these vital and fundamental human rights is even more necessary now than it ever was. We can't be facing a situation where if we have an economic downturn due to COVID and other things going on in this country and globally at the moment, that people face being evicted into homelessness, for example. We shouldn't have a situation where children from poorer backgrounds are facing potentially having their education put back months, if not years, because they have not been able to attend school for the last 5 months. So one thing that, again, we can learn from this, that we can put in place to ensure that as we move forward, we don't have the continuing severe impacts on people's human rights, is to ensure that their economic and social rights, the bare minimum, are protected in law to ensure that, you know, if there are further lockdowns, if we are here to live with COVID for a long time, that those very, very basic rights that we need in order to live are being protected in the same way that our right to a fair trial is protected in law.
Thanks, Naomi. That was really useful. It's really full of insights and really interesting to hear the big calls to protect human rights at this point in COVID-19 and for the future. You've been listening to Human Rights 2020s. Thank you.